Justice will come to order, the quorum being present. Representative Boland moves the minutes of the March 23rd meeting. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. We'll take Representative Hillstrom's up first because she has a committee starting. She chairs the chair, so Representative Hillstrom, do you want to move your bill?
I do, Mr. Chair. I would move that House Bill 818 be recommended to pass be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Policy and Oversight.
Hey, Representative Hillstrom, go ahead and present your
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, this bill was brought to me by the Vulnerable Adults Justice Project. More than 52 agencies, entities, and organizations, more than 125 individuals have been involved in developing this proposal. 50 to 60 individuals participated in each of 8 stakeholder meetings. 10 subcommittees divided the work on specific issues to bring recommendations to the stakeholder groups meetings, and more than 323 individuals across Minnesota participated in a 39-question online survey to gain broad input on issues and gaps in the Vulnerable Adults Act. And so, Mr. Chair, as you know, the financial abuse costs cost elders more than $6.2 billion annually. And this is Minnesota's attempt to deal with this issue. And with that, I thank you.
State your name,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Wright. I'm a law professor at the University of St. Thomas School of Law, where I teach and supervise the Elder Law Practice Group in our Legal Services Clinic. Licensed attorney in Minnesota, Oregon, California. I've practiced elder law for over 20 years. I've served as a member of the stakeholders group that the representative referred to. And I'll be speaking to Section 13 of the bill, which creates private right of action for victims of financial exploitation. In our practice group at the University of St. Thomas, I supervise students who are representing low-income elders who have been subject to financial exploitation. Our clinic is, as far as I know, the only resource available for individuals to pursue recovery of assets stolen because, of course, once they have been financially exploited, they are generally indigent and are not able to afford private counsel. We are a very small clinic. We can take about 20 cases per year. All of our cases are in the metro area. About half of these cases involve financial exploitation, and we must turn away probably twice as many cases as we can accept. Minnesota currently does not have a private cause of action specifically intended to allow financially exploited and vulnerable adults to recover their assets from the exploiter. Private right of action in this bill is based on the need for a clear cause of action tailored to the typical situation in a financial exploitation case. Proving these cases can be exceptionally difficult, because the very same circumstances that permitted the individual to be financially exploited in the first place often make it extremely difficult to gather the necessary facts to prove the exploitation. Also, often the United States may not be huge. It doesn't make sense for anyone other than a clinic, which is educating law students in the process, to put, say, $12,000 worth of attorney time in order to recover $10,000 worth of money. However, that $10,000 can make an enormous difference in the quality of life for the vulnerable adult. The unusual difficulty of these cases, as well as the particularly hateful nature of the offense against some of our most vulnerable citizens, justifies the enhanced penalties provided in Section 17. Provision of attorney's fees paid to a successful plaintiff is important in order to hope to attract private attorneys to represent victims in such cases, but not have the entire recovery swallowed up by the attorney's cost of representation. Our legal clinic alone cannot begin to meet the need in this state. Task Force researched 9 other states which have established such private rights of action, one of which is the state of Oregon, and I helped to draft that in 1995, the Elder Abuse Prevention Act, Oregon revised statutes. We based our provision on what we thought were the best aspects of all of these statutes. The provision, as we have drafted it, benefits financially exploited vulnerable adults by giving them a better chance to be able to recover their money. It benefits the state by providing an opportunity to restore these victims' ability to pay their own medical bills instead of relying on medical assistance. And the only parties not benefited by this provision are the financial exploiters themselves, which seems quite appropriate. Thank you.
Mr. Jerry, I have one final witness. I'll be great.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Kevin Hansen. I work with the Elder Care Rights Alliance as a client advocate, and I'm also a graduate from William Mitchell College of Law. The remaining provisions that I just wish to briefly touch on revolve around the bank's cooperation with prosecutors, law enforcement, and lead agencies who are investigating financial exploitation. And these crimes are important because they have a time element in two respects. The first is that the money can disappear very, very quickly in many situations. And the second is that these crimes are often more difficult to discover and take a longer period of time to do so. So within the bill in front of you in sections 1, 2, 3, 11, and 12, we clarify and confirm immunity for financial institutions when they report in good faith and also when they cooperate with law enforcement, a lead agency, and prosecutors in the turning over of records pursuant to judicial or administrative subpoenas. We also draft within Section 6 in the county attorney's subpoena power the ability for county attorneys to access the records of a vulnerable adult pursuant to an ongoing investigation, and it would only be the records of that vulnerable adult, and they would have to still submit an administrative subpoena, which satisfies concerns as far as privacy of the information and the interest to protect the vulnerable adult and get involved before all the assets have been completely diminished. Thank you.
Randy. Are there any opposition? Renews her motion. Pass House File 818. Send it to Health and Human Services Policy. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed, all carries. Sam Bigham. House File 388. And this goes to the General.
Yes, sir. I do have an amendment.
I'll move the amendment H3. Put it in the shape the author wants. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
First, Mr. Chair, I want to say thank you to you for giving me a hearing on the bill. I appreciate that. The bill 388 as amended, I will let my testifier, Mary Lee, who's a constituent of mine, explain the premise behind the bill. But basically what 388 does as amended is when a person is on a stay of commitment, they will not be, they'd be prohibited from participating in a psychiatric clinical drug trial while that court order is in effect. And the amendment we just added would say if that stay of commitment is continued, that the treating physician has to submit an affidavit to the court to say that the treatment, that they can participate in a clinical drug trial because all the other treatment options have been ineffective. It also states that the treating physician may not be the psychiatrist conducting the clinical drug trial. So with that, I will turn this over to Mary Weeks, and I did send the committee the stories that the Pioneer Press did on this, and also the op-ed from Mr. Carl Elliott from Who's a Violet, that you may be joining us if we are still doing the testifying as he gets here. So.
Mr. Chair, thank you. My name is Mary Weiss, and I have been working with Carla on this bill because of what happened to my son, Dan Markinson. Dan died 5 years ago. It'll be May 8th, 2004. Dan graduated from college, moved to Los Angeles to pursue screenwriting. In the spring of 2003, I had reason to believe something was wrong. I went down there and discovered that he was mentally ill. I spent the summer getting him home to Minnesota and finally in the fall into a hospital to hopefully be treated for his mental illness. Instead, Dan was put into a clinical study. He was taken to court, given a stay of civil commitment, and ordered by the court to get treatment for his mental illness. The doctor involved signed a statement indicating that Dan did not have the capacity to make a decision regarding neuroleptic medication. But yet, 1 week later, Dan was signed into a study, CAFE, comparison of atypicals to the first episode, and given an aftercare directive that we did not find out about until after Dan died, that indicated that if he did not attend all the CAFE study meetings, he would be put into Anoka Hospital. Had this bill been law 5 years ago, Dan would be alive. and I am hoping that you will approve it because of all the people who fall into the same situation as my son. Dan was not an anomaly. There are many others who are ordered to get treatment and find themselves in a study. A study is in no way treatment. The University of Minnesota differentiates itself in the difference between a clinical study and research. I hope that you will understand the importance of this bill and the lives that it will save in the future. Thank you.
Seeing this, first I'm going to ask, is there any
and then Mr. Elliott did come in.
All witnesses in there.
Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Roberta Olpine, the State Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities, and I will be extremely succinct for the chair's benefit and the committee's benefit. Our agency does death and serious injury reviews of people who are receiving treatment for mental health services. In addition to that, we operate civil commitment training and resource centers. I want to quickly state to you, this is not about clinical drug studies per se, because we firmly support the need for knowledge and education and the person's individual right to choose to participate in it. The number one issue I want to make is an issue of whether or not it's true informed consent. The person has a court order that says you must follow all the recommendations of your treatment provider, and if you do not, you will have your liberty interest taken away and you will be sent to most likely an Metro Regional Treatment Center to have treatment against your will. When a document like that exists and someone says, I'm your doctor and I recommend treatment, we question the level of informed consent, because if you don't follow the recommendations of the doctor and enter the study, you risk losing your liberty. It's a civil liberty issue to us, not a research issue.
Be brief. My name is Carl Elliott. I teach at the Center for Bioethics at the University of Minnesota and work on research ethics. Just to add, and I apologize just to add to what Roberta said about informed consent, I just want to make two points. The first is that any drug study is going to carry some risks. Sometimes the risks are very small, sometimes they're not small. And by that I mean that sometimes a patient or a subject is given drugs that don't work. Sometimes they're given drugs that make them worse. Sometimes they're given drugs that have side effects that are as bad or worse as the illness, all of which means that being in a research study is different from getting standard treatment. The second thing that I think I would want to emphasize is that what this bill will do is simply put into law what a lot of psychiatric research studies already say themselves, which is that if you look at studies of new psychiatric drugs, new antipsychotic drugs in particular, which are the kinds of drugs that this population of patients will be getting, if you look at those trials, you'll see that most of them say already, do not recruit patients who are at risk of suicide or violence. And what this bill would do would simply codify what the studies say already.
Ms. Ackerholden, do you want to speak or just say you're in the...
That was before now me before was that commitment does not take away people's rights to make decisions, and that not everyone who is committed is suicidal or prone to violence. It also includes that you're not able to take care of yourself. NAMI sees the broad range of people who have been first episode of mental illness and people who have struggled for it for many, many years. And I think for, especially for the individuals who struggled for years to find the right type of treatment and the treatment methodology that they could actually adhere to. Research provides hope. Research provides possibly something that may work in the future or may work right then and there. So we were very concerned about the original draft of the bill, that it really was an absolute, that you couldn't participate, and we have people who are on a continual commitment, you know, for many, many years. So the amendment helps so that it can at least allow people who are really struggling with their illness and who want to try something new in the hopes that it will work, that will, the amendment kind of helps that happen then. So, thank you.
The motion is renewed to pass House File 388 as amended. Say aye.
Aye.
Representative Overmiller, I don't and is there any?
Oh, Your Honor, sorry, Mr. Yeah, I had a court thing going on here. So, others. Oh, okay. Thank you. Actually, we do have one oral amendment, Mr. Chair. I apologize, and it's on line 6.88. There's a reference to an N in parentheses there, and it actually should be a G. Sure, it's on line 6.8 of the bill. This power of N, but it should actually be a G.
Be G. Oh, I say yes. Okay. I will move that amendment. All in favor of the amendment, say aye. All opposed, no.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with me today is Captain Kristen DeCharles, who is an Air Force member who is here today to answer questions if we need to. But basically, this bill sets up an alternative power of attorney. It's a short form for members of our military that are deployed outside of the state or on active duty outside of the state. And recently there's been some stories that have hit the press that are kind of disturbing and unfortunate about family members who are not necessarily family members, but trusted people to the military personnel who have been given a power of attorney, traditional power of attorney, and then they have been taken advantage of with their property being transferred kind of against their will while they're out of service. And so the goal of this bill here is to give an alternative form that limits the powers a little bit more for the power of the attorney, in fact, who is the person who kind of gets to call the shots while the military service person is deployed. And the key features of this bill basically are three or four. And one is that it prevents the attorney, in fact, from transferring the property to him or herself. Most can't be the service personnel person and their funds and transfer it to yourself. It automatically expires when the service has been completed, and it's ineffective unless the service personnel is actually out of state. And so it's basically a way to say, well, I'm out of state. I've been deployed either out of the country or I'm, you know, stationed somewhere else. I can have someone back here running my finances that I trust, but they don't have, you know, complete control over all of my goods so that they can take advantage of it. And maybe the last highlight I want to point out is this is what we would call a not durable power of attorney, and that means essentially that if the principal, the service person, becomes incapacitated, this power of attorney would end. The goal behind that being that this doesn't continue on after the service is done. So especially if the personnel was unfortunately wounded or unable to come back and make a decision one way or another on what to do with the current power of attorney, because of an injury or because they're incapacitated, this would end and some other, you know, statute would list that into place. And so hopefully we can ask you to support on this bill. Of course, we'll stand for any questions.
Thank you. Is there any opposition to this bill?
No.
One second. No, I'm just asking the audience if there's opposition so we know whether we need to hear from a witness. But
person doing it by fraud, there's always that possibility, but no forfeiture. But what we're trying to do is set up a claim, essentially, would be against the that person. If you did that and you transferred the property to yourself, especially in terms of real property as opposed to a personal property, that would actually be a new violation. It wouldn't otherwise. It would normally, if you check the N box, which is the everything box, it normally would have the authority to do that yourself. But nothing, as far as cash transfers, there is no restriction on cash transfers except in the case of fraud.
Representative Jackson.
And I think it's a nice idea, and not to belabor this, but I'm wondering if in the standard statutory short form power of attorney is simply elected that the attorney in fact could not transfer property onto the attorney in fact, and if you elected that be non durable, isn't it aren't you achieving the same goals?
In fact, you would be able to do that as you go through. The reality, though, unfortunately, is these are being done. I shouldn't say it in every situation, but often being done at the last minute. I know from my personal experience, I had a brother-in-law deployed, and it was the week before he was gone. He's like, well, I guess we better do this. He's coming to my doorstep, and of course, I have to send him somewhere else with the conflict in that situation, but we want to have a form that we know is going to work and actually kind of accomplish the purpose by taking the form and running with it, which is often how these things are going. It'd be great if they had a chance to talk with an attorney who had been chance to talk to JAG officers in most situations, but we want to make sure we've got a form that kind of sets out the parameters where we're going to raise.
Mr. Chair, and that's the best argument of all, because lay people do get a hold of these forms, and they do run with them, and I've seen some really poorly drafted ones, so that sold me.
Contradictory.
So if you are confused by the fact that I'm talking about adult guardianship and this amendment speaks to minors, it's only for the sole purpose of clarifying that this section is for minors only. What we're talking about is for adults. Yeah, you can quickly flip through this, and Mr. Robert Tennyson is with me, hope he can give more detailed information. But the fact that we have an aging population that's very mobile is what brought this about. Very often, here's a perfect scenario, and I've had clients myself, where mom and dad may spend half of their year down in Florida, and if mom becomes incapacitated, dad may become her legal guardian or conservator in Florida. But now something happens to dad, and we need to move mom back. Minnesota is not going to recognize the guardianship. I may be mom's guardian down there. So we had a question of which state has jurisdiction when you live 6 months in two different places. Are we going to force people to go through the entire guardianship proceeding more than one time? And so this Uniform Act would resolve that, and I'm going to answer questions, but first I think about
Representative Jackson, I'm just looking at right now on the committee, you have majority of the members here are already authors on the bill. Is there anybody that's in opposition to this bill? Mr. Tennyson, do you have a tremendous compulsion to testify? Or I think that was a good choice. Representative Jackson renews her motion to pass House File 632 as amended and send it to the General Register. All in favor say aye. All opposed, no. Carry. We'll try again. Are you back again? Okay. Representative Hayden. Representative Hayden, I'll move your bill 1394, and I believe that goes to public safety.
Yeah, I think that was correct.
Representative Hayden, do you have any amendments to it?
We do.
We have. Is this the A1 and the A2 amendments?
That's correct.
Okay, I will move the A1 amendments to get it partially in the shape you want. All in favor say aye. All opposed, no. Carries. I will now move the A2 amendment to get it the rest of the shape you want. All in favor say aye. All opposed, no. You may have problems if you can't get an eye out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I am bringing House File 1394 as amended. It is a property bill, essentially. One of the issues that we have, especially in the city, which I can agree to, we have about 3,000 properties that have been abandoned on foreclosure in 2008, and we're on pace for that in 2009. And one of the significant issues that we have with foreclosed and abandoned properties is just that they're abandoned, no one is taking care of them, and that the 6 month time that they go into foreclosure before I go into jail cell before they finish, people are breaking into those units, they're sometimes stripping off the copper, or at least they were last year when the commodity was high. They are squatting, which may be another issue in which they were homelessness, but they are squatting, they are sometimes selling drugs, they're sometimes getting into prostitution. And in my district, we've been hit particularly hard, as well as the chair of the campaign for a fact. What we're hoping to do here is to shorten that. We have the ability to shorten the redemption period from 6 weeks to 5 weeks. My understanding that the property owner can do that, or the owner of the sheriff's ticket or the mortgage order can do that now, but the city doesn't have the ability to do that. We are also, once getting the redemption period shortened, are asking that we ask the property owner, mortgage holder, person who holds a chair certificate. Did you know the minimum thing that we think it would take before they can turn over the property, like the chair? You know, make sure that that is locked on it, make sure that the windows are locked. They can do things like, obviously, boarded, though I'm not a big fan of boarded private property, but that's what it says. You can put an alarm in the property if it's necessary so that the communities aren't being terrorized by the unfortunate act of this house going into foreclosure. Today, we have Officer Jackson here from the police department who is responsible for the boarded property in Minneapolis. I think we had a PowerPoint presentation that we really wanted to show you, but we didn't know the dynamics of the room, and so we won't be able to do that today. But we do have a handout that Ms. Reed will handle. Once again, I think that one of the things that we found, and this is happening, you know, there was just an article on the Sunday paper that showed that invasion of border properties we're having those happen all over Minnesota. In particular, the suburbs have a lot of invasion of border properties where the suburbs, the subdivision have developed. So, though we're bringing this on behalf of the city of Minneapolis, it is not exclusively a Minneapolis issue. And what we're hoping to do is to get those properties secure in a quick and a fair amount of time so that whatever the distance is from the property can handle, we can hopefully get the back. So, with that, yes, absolutely.
Is there anybody that wants to speak against this bill? Officer Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for this opportunity to speak with you in regards to this. It is an urgent and one of an issue of very big importance, as was just explained. There's the pamphlet that's being passed out to everyone. And as was mentioned before, it was a PowerPoint presentation that was put together. Sam, we don't have to point that. So if you could just follow along with me, what I have, it brings a vivid picture to the problem that foreclosed properties and nuisance properties bring. As mentioned before, my name is Officer Jackson. I am the public property nuisance property specialist for the 4th Precinct in North Minneapolis. North Minneapolis is one of the areas that is hardest hit with foreclosed properties. When people think about foreclosed or nuisance properties, they think about the properties that have a for sale sign in front, or they think about the properties whereby the kid plays the radio too loud down the block, or the house where the car pulls up in front and you hear the boombox. But looking at the second slide, you can see that we're experiencing problems with nuisance properties as far as gang house, copper thefts, narcotics, party houses, which are really big, and prostitution. A lot of these things are what are causing the problems with nuisance properties. If you flip over to the next page, in thinking like the bad guy, how does this all come together and how does it work? First, you need a house, and a lot of the properties that are targeted are foreclosed properties. One of the things that happen is because of the redemption period, when someone is removed from the property, they will actually sell the key. Sometimes the keys will be sold for $200. From there, he's just sold. The bad guy knows the banks are not going to be around for 4 to 6 months to do anything with this property. So during that time period, one of the things that happens is they turn into a party house. They charge anywhere from $5 to $10 just to get into the door of a problem property. A lot of these properties don't have running water. They do not have toilet facilities, things of that nature. After they use it for a party house, and we come and we spot the party house, everyone leaves. When we leave, normally at a party, you expect the homeowner to be there or the person who's renting the property, that type of thing. When everyone leaves, we find a vacant house. We find no one, no furniture, no one lives there, so it's really no one to go after or no one to charge. And the people who run these parties know that. After the parties, the house is sold again, the keys are sold again, it becomes a drug house, whereby prostitution and drug activity is started. After that takes place, we leave, then the copper is stolen. And then it hits the property as an abandoned property and one that needs to be ripped down and torn down because it's no longer usable, it's condemned. So that's kind of the process that's been happening over the past couple of years. The problem is no one is responsible for the house and no one takes responsibility until it's too late. And it's one of the focuses of this bill. If you look at the next slide, it talks about the Glenwood waterfront. That's one of the problem properties in North Minneapolis.
graffiti, do drugs, things of that nature. We've had several, we had two deaths that occurred from this particular property. If you look at the next page, and this really doesn't show the actual problem as it exists, but if you see the house, it looks like a normal house when you get inside. The water's been shut off, it's been used for prostitution. Prostitution was running still rampant there. Cases of condos. They had actual cases of condos that were used in the property. Someone lost their state. They have been missing for 6 months. We actually found them. That's the picture that you see there. The next slide, it talks about gangs and the gang activities. Gangs are actually coming into these properties and using them as places to group, plan robberies, things of that nature. These are robberies that are never taking place. And you can see the big market territory there. Drug activity, see the house looks like a normal house. The house was actually open, the front door. There was no lock on it. We walked right in. And then right on the counter was a 12-gauge shotgun, fully loaded, ready to go. There was marijuana, there was ecstasy that was there, and this was an abandoned house. It was one that was foreclosed on. No one had possession of it, per se, but it was being used for drug activity. The next property is the copper theft that actually took place. We had actually been to the house two times before, but we couldn't take any action because we didn't know who owned it. And what you're looking at there in the final picture is where they were actually taking the copper from the air conditioners. Air conditioners are a huge problem now with copper theft, with the houses there foreclosed and abandoned. If you look at the next picture, it shows whereby the house was exploded from being went in, they stole the copper, they let the house fill up with gas, and there was actually an explosion. The explosion was so large that it damaged the houses on both sides of the property. The picture after that, or the slide after that, shows the health aspect of it. A lot of foreclosed and problem properties. The child that you see is infected with ringworm. The reason that the child is infected with ringworm is because water was cut off. They kept using the toilet facilities. Toilet facilities overflowed, and it actually imploded in the basement. There's probably 2 to 3 inches of sewage in the basement. This created a natural habitat disease whereby it went through an entire house. Missing plots of air. We had to quarantine the house. We had to quarantine the kids. My partner actually had to go to the hospital and get checked out. This is all from a foreclosed property. It's party houses. There's a lady that's named A.K. Bright Eyes. She's notorious for going around and she will offer you $200 for your key. And get $200 being that you kicked out of your house. That's a lot of money. That's a week of groceries or whatever. They come in, they throw a party. Then after they throw the party, they leave. She was convicted of throwing these parties. Whereby she lost one house that she actually owned. Now they're currently going after a house that she owns in Brooklyn Park. Everybody knows it was A.K.A. Bright Eyes. You can actually go on the internet and see where she's advertising these parties, things of that nature. And she does it at foreclosed properties. Whenever we're dealing with any of these properties, it takes a lot of resources, as you can see in the last slide here. You have the fire department. You have ECMC, paramedics. You see the water department, because they have to be called out. And the, one of the slides, you see a whole SWAT team, whereby sometimes we do have to use the SWAT team to go into these properties, animal control. And this happens on a regular basis when we're dealing with these properties because so many issues coming.
Language of the bill applies not just to the scenarios that Officer Jackson was describing, but I'm thinking of a case in my area where someone had been foreclosed upon, and it was their post-sale redemption period, and the motion was made by the lender, and I understand that you would extend that to the city to reduce the redemption period to 5 weeks. And their claim was abandonment of the property because the property had been lived out. In fact, the homeowner had emptied the house in preparation to sell it, which was for right during
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Melissa Reed, Government Relations with the City of Minneapolis. And to that point, both in this budget and in other places, the law does differentiate between vacant and unoccupied and abandoned. They are segmented in the statute. And what we have done here is tailor this to abandoned, and there are six point definition of what abandoned is. And we also have set up a process in here through which, if I can have the most recent language, I can give you the citation, that the city serves notice that it is seeking a shortened redemption period, and there is a time period for the owner of the property, the holder of the share certificate, to come to the city. We already have a process in place that we have right now to adjudicate abandoned properties and nuisance properties, to come and tell us that it's not abandoned.
I noticed that it left the owner's agent in the purposes of notice, but our taxpayer, and I'm wondering, will the notice go both to the borrower who has been foreclosed upon as well as the holder of the sheriff's certificate?
Madam Chair and committee members, what we've done currently, if you're looking at subdivision 2, and then you're looking at in lines 1-5 through 1-2-7, 1-2-4, is that where you're looking at? On the A2.
Okay.
That's where you're looking, Madam Chair?
The
intent was to preserve subdivision 2, that the notice of that the property is vacant and occupied and open to trespass still goes to all of the same people that it currently goes to. The attempt then in sub B, and we actually do have an oral amendment, I think, to address your concern, was to then include notification that the property was first open to trespass, and that the holder of the certificate, the holder of the mortgage, was then also required, if the property was abandoned, to come and secure the property. And that was the intent in 1-5 through 1-2-4, that those notices could happen at the same time. So we worked with House and Senate Council, and they thought that the language we had here was adequate, but we were also prepared, because the same concern was brought up by the Bankers Association, to offer an oral amendment on 1-6, 1-1-1-6, and 1-1-9 to make the addition of the holder of the mortgage certificate. Oftentimes, when you look at the records, the notice to taxpayer, the taxpayer, and the holder and the owner of the property are two separate entities, especially right now when we're dealing with foreclosures. And currently for a city to go and it's already a tremendous burden for us to be notifying all of these entities as it is. And for us to go and pay the title to pull the tax record can be very challenging. So it's about $100 each, and it's a significant cost burden for us. We are doing it, though. We are notifying both, but we were just under the impression that the language we have now, as long as we added mortgage or in here, would satisfy the notification. Madam Chair and Representative Portman, yes, the intent was, and I'll leave this to Representative Hayden to move it, on 1-1-6, before the word sheriff, add mortgage or. So it would read, informs the owner and the holder of any mortgage or sheriff certificate. And then the same would be done on lines 1.19, informs the owner and the holder of any mortgage or sheriff certificate. Madam Chair and Health Research, I guess I said that, if I can address you directly. Under advisement from Senate Council, we were actually told to not make that change in Subdivision 3. And if I can read the handwriting, that Subdivision 3 only applies to the holder of a share certificate right now, so it would not be consistent to add that in Subdivision, in Subsection 3, just in 1 and 2. Why don't you do what has the next page? Since you're going to be working on amending it anyway, I'm going to do it. Okay. Now, I believe we have someone who wants to testify in opposition. Please state your name for the record.
Kevin Dunphy, and I co-chair the Legislative Committee for the Real Property Section of the State Bar Association. I wouldn't say I'm totally opposed to this bill. I just have some technical corrections in the transition dates and some of the language that I'd like to suggest to the committee. The discussion that was just had, I also sent to council. That's only dealing with sheriff's certificate, the statute that's referred to in that clause. Point 3.1, I suggest that the date be changed from June 1 to August 1. Line 3.17, I suggest that the date be August 1. Language should substitute the following. Sections effective August 1. Cancellations of contract relief. Insert the following language. The notice of cancellation is first served or published on or after August 1, 2009. Continuing on, I can do
something. Okay. Mr. Donnelly, have you had an opportunity to talk with Representative Hayden about those changes? I'm assuming that the August 1 deadline change is for conformity of other areas of the.
We have not had a chance to talk.
It sounds to me like that you're not changing the gist or the essence of the bill.
One substantive change. All my changes are on transition dates. Suggestion is on line 4.35. If the following language be inserted before the period, summons to complaint shall be delivered by certified mail to the foreclosing attorney.
Now, are you looking at the A2 amendment?
Yes.
Okay. And go ahead again. And
so 4.35, line 4.35, insert before the period sentence. And the summons to complaint shall be delivered by certified mail foreclosing attorney. And the purpose of the intent of that is if the city is going to shorten up the redemption period, you really want the creditor to know about it because then the whole purpose of the five-week redemption statute is to get the creditor to take possession of the property. The foreclosing attorney, that's a redemption period, has changed from 6 months to 5 weeks. Possession of listeners are intended to give the foreclosing attorney notice that the city has gotten.
All right. Well, I think, since you're going to go on to public safety, Representative Hayden, I think we'll give you an opportunity to talk further with Mr. Dunleavy. Those sound like sorts of changes.
redemption period, I mean, that's a blessing for the creditor more than a curse. It's the homeowner that's losing their redemption period that's potentially getting harmed here the most. Am I understanding that correctly? And then I have another question.
Well, Madam Chair, it's a question. My understanding of the bill is that it is only the case of the abandoned property. So it doesn't hurt the homeowner if they have it abandoned their property. This is really good for the property. I was just trying to talk about property that people have left and that other people are taking possession of inappropriately.
And Ms. Madam Chair, how do we determine it's been abandoned? I understand that if it's got a gang participating in criminal activities, it's easy to understand. What if the party has moved to Florida to get a job to try to earn enough money to redeem it within the six months?
Thank you, Madam Chairman, to the Western. I'm going to allow Mr. Reed to answer working closely with him. There are some particular ways to be concerned as a property has been abandoned.
Madam Chair and Representative Westrom, I can't give you the citation right now. I can give that to you immediately after. But there is a definition in statute as to what abandoned actually means. It's a 6-point definition and includes things like broken windows, evidence of trespass, buildup of garbage and debris on the property. And it is defined separately in statute as opposed to a property that is, as you described in your example, maybe unoccupied because someone maybe goes to Florida in the winter, for example, or it's vacant because it's a model home, something like that. It's a very distinct, separate definition in statute. Oh, I'm sorry, we do have it, Representative. It's 582.032. Definition of abandoned.
So, Madam Chair, Ms. Reese, do all 6 points have to be met to be abandoned, or is that just a guideline if these exist, any one of these exist, you consider it abandoned? I don't have the statute.
Madam Chair, Representative Western, no, all 6 points do not have to be met. There is, however, a court process. And the homeowner or even the holder of their share certificate has the right to come to that hearing and present evidence to the fact that the property is not abandoned.
Two more questions, Madam Chair, and I'll try to ask them together because they kind of coincide. To whoever can best answer this. So what kind of cost potentially would the creditor or the homeowner, if they redeem, be subject to in this case? And is there any liability or any effort that the city police have to put on trying to protect this property? If, let's say the homeowner or the creditor boards it up. To what extent are they going to have to do? Stand outside the day and night and sleep there just so nobody can get in? Or what is the cost to them? And at some point, you can only control who trespasses, and that's what we have a police force paid for to help control as well. Where do the costs transition from the city to the homeowner or the creditor, and how much is the creditor or homeowner going to be subject to versus the city?
Madam Chair and Representative Lester, I'm going to begin to answer the question, and I might also ask Officer Jackson to contribute to my response as well. Court costs are limited to $250 for the homeowner to come and contest the order the finding that the property has been abandoned. In terms of the cost to the city and the amount of time and staff time that is spent managing these properties, I can tell you that it, for us, is massive. We are talking in the upwards of well over $3 million a year in terms of boarding properties, officer time spent patrolling the properties, and the time of very limited resources for the city. I am pointing right now at the entire Problem Properties Unit for North Minneapolis. This one officer is all that we have. He developed his very own computer system to track hundreds of foreclosed properties in his precinct because we don't have the resources to have a citywide computer system, let alone one that is coordinated with the county. So we are absorbing millions of dollars in resources in terms of well over $2,000 per property that it costs to board, talking about animal control resources coming, time spent abating the health hazards that we're finding in these properties. So we feel that that this is a reasonable request to make given the cost associated with, again, the max of $250 to come and contest the signing of abandonment. And in addition, when you look at the redemption period, the one thing that really surprised me when I started to worry about this issue was that redemption doesn't mean what I thought that it meant. Redemption doesn't mean paying back what you owe. Redemption means paying off the entire note. And we know that less than 2% of homeowners who go through the redemption period are actually able to successfully redeem their property, which means that property is vacant for an incredibly large, long period of time. And we're just trying to do our best to manage the over 3,000 foreclosures we have every year.
Madam Chair, Ms. Reed, and I understand or appreciate the magnitude of the problem. I don't know if there's anybody here from the banking association or anybody, credit unions or creditors. It seems to be telling us that you're shifting that $3 million of cost from your department to basically the creditors who are probably losing on this property in the first place. Are you basically going to board it up and send them the bill? What if they don't do it? What kind of penalty is in place? Because at some point, if the property's a loss anyways, they're probably going to just say, why add another $2,000 of cost to continuing to board this up every other day if the trespassers seem to do that? How extensive, how often will they have to come back out there if somebody's determined to get into the property? Or do you follow where I'm going with this question?
Madam Chair, Representative Westrom, yes, I do. The language that we put into this bill in terms of how often we would ask them to take a look and check out their abandoned properties is, I think the language used was reasonable. Reasonable periodic inspections. And that, of course, is broad and left open to interpretation because we also recognize that the banks and the loan servicers are facing a burden right now, too. They are trying to manage a lot of these properties as well. If the property is not secured, we would continue to do what we do now, which was we go to the property, we front the money, we pay a third party over $2,000 per property to board it up, and then assess that cost back to the property. And then, we hopefully will make up, we typically make maybe 70% of that back in the long run once that property is hopefully turned around. If the property is turned around, we usually can recoup about 70% of the cost of boarding it up. If the property continues to deteriorate, and that is why it's so important that we shorten the redemption period, because over that six-month period, the property deteriorates and deteriorates, and more of the destruction that Officer Jackson described occurs, and we go from a house that maybe has some broken windows to start with to a house that now needs to be completely torn down.
Madam Chair, and I know we're just dragging the bill out a little bit, but I hope we understand the magnitude of this bill. I don't know, do we have anybody sign up to testify opposed to this, Madam Chair?
Madam Chair and Representative Westrom, I can tell you that we have been working on this with some of the groups that you mentioned, the bankers and things like that, and we have addressed some of their concerns have been addressed here.
And let me just make this, my concluding remark, but I think the bankers probably may like this because they aren't big fans of having the whole property out for 6 months when only 2% of the party's redeemed. So, ironically, there's people that are probably supporting this bill that 20 years ago would have been the ones beating the drum to have a 6 month redemption period. And maybe that redemption period isn't working. I know banks, and I'm not here to defend banks, they can defend themselves, but as businesses and communities as well, they're the ones that have to hold the bag for 6 months rather than a period of run, with only with 98% of the people, according to your statistic, walking away from the property. That's basically saying the banks are sitting for 6 months when they could be turning these properties around faster. You wouldn't have this trespass problem. And so maybe that whole redemption needs to be reexamined with this bill, if that's the facts. But why we should make the cities whole, and in other terms, make the lending institution whole the bank, if somebody isn't going to redeem anyways, it seems a bit opposite of what the redemption period is really trying to do. Because back to my original question, what if somebody is legitimately wanting to redeem? I know a situation of a family that basically moved down to Galveston, Texas recently just because that's where work is. Because of the hurricane last summer, a contractor, and so their home potentially is vacant right now. I don't know that they're in foreclosure or not. I know work has been short, so that was the reason that they drove down there, the whole family, to do that. But what if that scenario had a foreclosure and a redemption, and somebody for some reason decided to vandalize the property, and all of a sudden their redemption period would be shortened from 6 weeks to 6 months to 5 weeks? They're short of money already and clearly out of state. It's going to be hard to fight any of this. So I think my caution might be just be careful what we're doing. If you want to change this redemption period, then we should probably look at that. But I'm afraid there could be some unintended consequences with this, as well as shifting a lot of burden to the homeowners or the lenders and stuff that maybe the police department should be monitoring these properties a little closer just when they do drive-bys in the neighborhoods.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify in favor or against the bill? Otherwise, hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion passes and the bill is moved on to public safety and opportunity to work on the amendments.
The next bill we have for consideration is House File 1537.
Representative Mallory, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House File 1537 to the General Register, and then I have an amendment.
All right. Let's move your amendment.
Yes, Madam Chair, I move the A1 amendment today.
All right, any questions about the amendments? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All right. To your bill as amended, Representative Mallory.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. As you've probably read, maybe some of you have actually seen, certain parts of North Minneapolis, a little bit of South Minneapolis, east side of St. Paul, Frogtown, certain other areas are just being was destroyed in some ways by the foreclosure crisis, and totally something no one ever expected would happen. And there's a lot of properties that are really run down, and the cities need anything possible to try to help stem this tide and reverse and stabilize the areas. There's some really good studies done by the Institute on Race and Poverty here in Minnesota, but even nationally, especially by Bruce Katz at the Brookings Institution, which is a very highly regarded national think tank, on the effects of having concentrated poverty in small areas, and especially with rundown properties and how it contributes to crime, it contributes to huge problems in the schools and just an overburden of other social services in the area. And so we're trying to help the cities deal with this. And what this does is allow a very narrow use of eminent domain on areas that are really hard hit by foreclosures, either in targeted areas or the federal HERA tracts. And tonight, to testify, we have Melissa Manderscheid from the Minnesota Foreclosure Partners Council, and Mark Ireland with the Foreclosure Relief Law Project. Sherry Schofust is here from Minneapolis, Robert Shire right here from Brooklyn Park, and Karen Reed from the Neighborhood Development Alliance, a neighborhood organization in St. Paul. First, I believe, would be Ms. Manderscheid.
Excuse me, one minute. Representative Mahoney, was there something you wanted to ask?
Correct something that the author of the bill said, that the East Side is not a disaster and is not run down, and the foreclosure has not significantly diminished the East Side. It has its problems, but it is not destroyed, nor is it run down.
Representative, the North Side hasn't been destroyed either, but one of your housing people for the city told me about how had just come back from driving by two blocks or two different places where.
Don't really need to go
on. Three blocks. Thank you. Please identify yourself. Sure, members. My name is Melissa Manderscheid. I'm Mr. Nate Kennedy. I'm here as the coordinator of the Minnesota Foreclosure Partners Council. I have a handout, actually a few handouts that were disseminated prior to my testimony. One of which is sort of a PowerPoint type thing on a piece of paper, so a bunch of squares. So I'll direct your attention to that while I'm coming through today. I've been asked to provide some brief opening remarks to highlight the nature and history of our state's foreclosure. As an opening introduction, some feedback background on the Foreclosure Partners Council I thought would be helpful, and it's more described in more detail on this particular document. But in a nutshell, it's Minnesota's coordinated approach to address our state's foreclosure crisis. The council includes representatives from the city, state, county, government, as well as nonprofits who serve the metro and greater. Coordinator efforts to address the mortgage foreclosure crisis in the state, and as I mentioned, it's more thoroughly described in this very wonderful document here. I also want to mention that this effort is funded through the general Housing Fund, the Greater Minnesota Housing Fund. There's a chart that's in the materials. It was prepared by Housing Link, a local nonprofit. It shows the dramatic increase in foreclosures from 2005 to 2008. Both Greater Min and the Metro have experienced a dramatic increase, with more than 26,000 foreclosures in 2008. Also included a couple of photographs that provide some examples of what the problem looks like. Earlier discussion here this evening talked about the abandoned subdivisions. I have a photo of that. Also have a picture of an abandoned property in a more urban setting. As you know, this is a challenge for both our urban neighborhoods and city departments, as well as our neighborhoods in our rural communities in Minnesota. The challenge with boarding the properties is that it announces to the community that these homes are vacant and abandoned and unattended, which leads to vandalism and neighborhood instability, which you've heard in the testimony of the previous bill. We've experimented with some techniques secure these properties without using boards, but they've been by and large ineffective and cost ineffective as an theft problem. In Greater Minnesota, those subdivisions are oftentimes ghost towns, and this is especially problematic given the fact that each foreclosure results in about a 1% drop in surrounding property values. So when you've got a large abandoned subdivision and just a couple of folks that are still living in that subdivision, you've got dramatic property drops, property value drops.
city of Brooklyn Park has been one community that has been especially impacted in our metro area. Hennepin County in general has experienced a sevenfold increase in the past 5 years in their number of foreclosures, with Brooklyn Park being especially hit. After Minneapolis and St. Paul, Brooklyn Park has the third most foreclosures in the state. During 2007 and 2008, there were 1,576 foreclosures in the city, 983 foreclosures in 2008 alone. Those are shown by the green dots on the map in your packet. And there's also, in the city of Brooklyn Park, 756 known vacant properties. Those are represented with red dots. As you can see by that map, every neighborhood in Brooklyn Park has been affected by vacancies and foreclosures. The city received $3.9 million in federal entity during this last round, and also received some money from Minnesota Housing from about 3 years ago. However, even with $3.9 million, the city's only going to be able to address about 78% of those foreclosures. That's less than 5% of the problem. It's not unique to the city of Brooklyn Park. Many other local governments are experiencing similar situations. In St. Paul, I provided some additional information on that city as well. The number of foreclosures has quadrupled from 2005 to 2008, and the city projects an additional 2,000 foreclosures during 2009. During the past year, St. Paul's foreclosures were generally concentrated in an arc north of the downtown area, but now the foreclosures have spread to every neighborhood in the city, even some of the most stable neighborhoods, such as Marion Park and Highland Park. Marion Park. I've also provided a bigger map for your convenience. One in the materials is pretty small, so there's a larger one here. It's the one with the purple dots on it. I've also provided an updated of vacancies. The map in your materials has orange dots. The one I'm referring to here has green dots. In addition to foreclosures, there are vacancies throughout the city as well. As of January 26, 2009, there were 2,006 vacant buildings in St. Paul. For all these maps and pictures, they don't really do the crisis justice. It's really impossible to explain what has happened as a result of these foreclosures and these vacant buildings. As an example, in Dayton's Bluff, property values have dropped 16% in a very short period of time. And that's just one example. It's happening all around due to the fact that these properties are sitting vacant and unattended. So you probably ask, what's going to happen next? There is some research that's out there, and a lot of thinking has gone into predicting what's going to happen. I have a chart in the materials here that shows what we've experienced to date, which is the orange bars. These are the subprime loans that have gone into foreclosure. Many of them have gone into foreclosure. And this next wave is in yellow. It shows the option arm and Alt-A loans. Many of these are yet to reset. The blue arrow marks where we are today. So that gives you any sense we're sort of on the bottom of this very scary steep. The bulk of these resets is going to occur in 2011. The gentleman who provided this material and spoke on 60 Minutes back in mid-December commented that things are going to be much worse than anyone anticipates. With 70% of the homeowners in these yellow bar option arm loans, they're going to default, and many will default before they even experience a reset in their mortgage. So that's nationally, and we've also looked at what the problem is going to be like in Minnesota. The next chart in your materials provides our own reset future. The red bars represent those subprime loans that have by and large already either gone into foreclosure or refinanced, hopefully. And as you can see, the bulk of those have already reset. But by comparison, the growing blue lines represent the reset for all pay loans. Again, our state is not unlike the rest of the nation. Our resets will be in 2011, the bulk of them. For those of you unfamiliar with Alt-A loans, they're also known as near prime, and they're oftentimes option arms, which means that there's a certain period of time where the borrower doesn't pay a full mortgage payment. And then the option arm resets, typically the homeowner will experience a jump in their mortgage payments. It's also important to note that in our current situation, we're talking about how interest rates are dropping, and so you think, well, this probably is going to help. But it's important to note that the interest rates that are dropping are for 30-year fixed interest rate loans.
whereas these interest rates that are resetting are short-term interest rates and aren't necessarily experiencing the same decreases in percentage, same drops in, not going down.
Representative Champion, I believe you have a question.
I have a couple questions. I'm sorry that I failed to get your name.
Melissa Manishite.
I have a couple questions. One, you said a number of things. One, you talked about 5% of, well, that is, that the state has gotten money, cities have gotten money, and even with those monies that we've received, only 5% of the problem would be addressed. Was that an accurate synopsis of what you said earlier? Testify, Melissa.
Chair, members, the several cities have and counties have received direct allocations from the federal government through the National Community Stabilization Program funds. Of those cities that have received funds, I'm familiar with calculations of two of those cities, and in both cases, those funds will address about 5% of the number of foreclosures that they have in their community.
And is it also not true that when we think in terms of money that's received, say Minnesota just recently, not long ago, there's a, you know, how you perceive it, received $58 million, $36 million to Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, and then respective cities like the city of Minneapolis received roughly $6 to $7 million. Isn't that right?
That's right. Chair members, I believe Ms. Schoquist is going to be testifying after me today, and she will have the exact dollar amounts that would be able to respond in specificity to your questions. I can say generally that's my understanding, but I believe Ms. Schoquist.
Is it also not true, if I might, that and perhaps the person from the vicinity of Minneapolis can ask this question, but I know this also has happened in other places or spaces, that monies that have been received by these respective cities and have received from the federal government into these respective cities, that instead of converting these homes into true affordable housing opportunities, that they've actually been demolishing these homes. Isn't that right?
Chair members, the money can be used for a variety of purposes, and one of which of those is demolition.
And so, if we think of the logical, it's logical to jump in with this particular tool of being able to recapture homes by way of eminent domain or under the sky that it being a public use. That public use, as we have seen exhibited by some of the cities, is destroying existing pieces of property. And therefore, no one is allowed to live in it, and it's become land bank property, correct?
Senator Schein. Chair members, I'm not sure, Representative Champion, that I understand the question.
Okay, let me put it this way. Is it not true that houses, money that have been used to demolish homes because there's a certain amount of money that the cities get from the federal government and from other entities to demolish or destroy abandoned homes, correct?
Chair members, correct. So some of the money that has been received from the federal government can be used for that purpose.
And then once the house is demolished, the land is vacant. And so the question becomes, what happens to the land that once had a house on it that is now vacant?
Chair members, I'm not sure exactly what is happening to each of the properties that are sitting vacant. I'm sure that the cities have plans. I know for a fact that many of them have very detailed plans that are addressing what they're going to do with properties that have buildings on them as well as properties that don't have buildings on them.
And so when we see in terms of the tax deal or this legislation that we have before us, is it not intended to be able to acquire property so the cities can do with it what they desire, which could include demolishing the home that exists on the piece of land? Isn't that right?
Ms. Manishite. Chair members, can I restate your question, Dr. Sherry? Is your question whether or not this bill would allow cities to acquire property or to condemn property or acquire property and use them in the domain so that they would subsequently demolish property on this? Is that your question?
Yeah. Could they use it for that desired outcome?
I think that is the case. I know that there are others that are from cities here that would be able to comment in greater detail on that.
Further testifiers? Please state your name for the record.
Robert Schreier, Director of Community Development, City of Brooklyn Park, and also representing the Florida, Maryland National Association of Housing Officials. And for the record, I just want to say, even though Brooklyn Park is the third largest portfolio in the city, and we're doing a lot of good things there. We do have about 30 portfolios and 800 vacant properties, and we did receive close to $4 million in federal dollars. And we have a three-part program on our foreclosures. You heard most about our statistics from Melissa, but I'll just talk a little bit higher some of those questions. We have three-part. We try and rehab the home, so we provide people with their money that they purchase homes. And in a suburban area, very few would go to demolition. However, you may, from time to time, have a demolition to keep your community livable. You may have a house that was abandoned or vacant that was burned. You purchase that. On that site. Last year, the legislature, thank you for passing the water shutoff. But we had a lot of homes that were water damaged last year that both got into that given the cost of very high value. Some of those homes are maybe low cost of down building. We see buying property in a suburban area, tearing it down, and then rebuilding it. It's probably the most piece of the money. Again, we got the money we got, we see that this bill gives us another weapon in our arsenal to treat the foreclosures. That's why City of Brooklyn Park in Minnesota Narrow supports this legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not for the official, but just as your testifier was coming, just a comment. In your opening remarks, you said nobody could have seen it coming. I do want to say that we signed a bill to the governor's desk last year that was vetoed that would have helped to freeze foreclosures and maybe prevent some of these problem properties from becoming problem properties. Maybe had we been more aggressive in dealing with some of these problems in 2009. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Mark Ireland. I'm from the supervising attorney at the Foreclosure Relief Law Project, and it's a program of the Housing Preservation Project. And I'll be brief tonight, but I wanted to specifically address Representative Champion's comments because I'm from the Housing Preservation Project, preservation being in our title, not the Housing Demolition Project. And I can say that working with the City of St. Paul and the City of Minneapolis and trying to address the overwhelming number of vacant and abandoned buildings, that the number of teardowns is really concerning. That being said, however, I do support this bill, and the reason is that we have 2,200 registered vacant properties in the City of St. Paul. It's an enormous number. If you were to just calculate that out and say, well, it's going to cost $50,000 to fix that up, it would be over $90 million. For the City of St. Paul or somebody in this day and age to have $90 million to fix up those properties. And over the past few years, you've seen more and more of them become major neighborhood nuisances. And not only that, health hazards to the kids who play there, the broken glass on the ground, the pipes being torn out. And this provides a tool, a limited tool, to cities to address the issue as it relates to those particular particular properties. And I'd certainly be open and to listening and working with folks to see if there's opportunities to make sure that this tool is not abused. But just in working with the city of St. Paul in Minneapolis, I know it's often a last resort. There's this perplexing, I want to address just two issues. One is timing. Every day that a property is vacant, it becomes harder and harder to repair and occupy. And so you have this issue of the longer that they're vacant, the longer that they're sitting there, it becomes more and more expensive and not economical to rehab and sell them or to have somebody occupy them. And you also have this perverse thing where you've got thousands of people out there who want affordable housing and need affordable rental housing. And then you also have these vacant properties that are sitting there. But I think what is at play is really economics. And I think that one of the arguments against this bill is that here we have willing buyers, the banks, who want to sell these properties. So why is the city, or why are you expanding this to provide for eminent domain to take over those properties and to acquire those properties? And it's the same thing that's at play with the struggle for affordable rental housing. You would think that in a free market where people are trying to get these streams of income, that somebody would actually rent out these houses, because certainly some income is better than no income. And what we have is the difference between the traditional banking system and what we have now, which is a securitized banking system, in which you have, instead of two parties or three parties, the bank who has a direct interest in the mortgage loan, now you've got a whole variety of players. You've got pooling and servicing agreements. You've got mortgages that have been turned into different income streams. And you've got requirements and restrictions in terms of whether or not they can enter into rental agreements with people. And so I think that this bill helps provide some rationality that's been sorely missing over the past two or three years. You would think that in a free market, one, that people would want to rent out these houses to people who can afford to pay their rent and want an affordable place to stay and would take care of it, but that is not happening. And I think that perhaps this bill can just be one tool to force some rational thought process.
Any questions? Oh, Representative Champion.
I'm sorry that I missed you.
Chairman and members of the committee, when I read this bill, I wasn't picturing you know, the bungalow in Hawthorne that a family was four was occupying, and you know, the husband or the wife lost their job, and then they went into foreclosure, and then a bank owned it, and that it's possible for someone to rent out, that it's possible for someone to buy and have it and live in it again. When I read this bill, the property that I think it addresses are the ones that the officer testified to, where you've got earlier this evening, where you've got it is not habitable anymore because the windows have been busted out. You've got mold growing in there that would be just a health hazard for anybody to occupy again. And so this would be a clear legal standard for cities to use to acquire those properties that it really can't be rehabilitated and rehabbed in an easy way. So that's not to dismiss that there are lots of opportunities and lots of policy options for that initial part, but the tool at the back end for the properties that just can't be lived in again, I think, is important.
Representative Chan, maybe just a couple more, otherwise we will be here all night. Go ahead.
Here's an interesting point. I think that when you deal with something as important as this, that it shouldn't happen during deadline week. So I'm just concerned. So I will go and then I will ask for roll call.
Any other questions for Ms. Ryan? Otherwise, there's another testifier.
Yes, I'm Karen Reed. I am the executive director of the Neighborhood Development Alliance on St. Paul's West Side. That'll be called the best side. Beautiful there. we work primarily in housing. We do foreclosure prevention and pre-purchase counseling. One of the things we also do is do development, rehabilitation of homes, and building new homes for sale to low moderate income families. We too are supporting this bill to have eminent domain be a tool for St. Paul to essentially assist the neighborhood in acquiring or gaining access to houses that have been essentially abandoned and are becoming a blight on the blocks. We see abandoned housing as actually essentially stealing from the neighbors. They impact equity. They discourage investment from homeowners on blocks of these buildings are situated from reinvesting, and that is part of our opportunity is to help homeowners reinvest in homes while we rehab and build new homes to try to make a stronger community. I think we've been pretty successful over the years. The West Side has certainly has its foreclosure problems, not as bad as some areas, and we are struggling to maintain. I just would like to mention that affordability of homes does not end with the ability to purchase a home or live in a home. Affordable homes is, can you afford to heat the home? We have an aging housing stock on the West Side, and we have visited and assessed abandoned homes, whether we would like to rehab them so they are energy efficient, so low, moderate income families can actually afford to stay in the home and heat them. And so we do an assessment whether it'd be more worthwhile to take the house down and build an energy efficient home and then resell it to a family that can afford.
With Representative Champion about his concerns, and then the
Shoquist. I'm the City of Minneapolis Foreclosure Project Coordinator. I work for Community Planning and Economic Development. And I'm here to provide a little bit of background information in support of this bill. But I'd like to start out by addressing everybody that can answer this question before providing background information. It's key to the discussion. And most of this conversation has focused entirely on properties in need of demolition. And I'm here to tell you that in Minneapolis, we need this bill also for properties that are not in need of demolition. That where clouded title is preventing very decent foreclosed properties that have purchasers waiting to buy them, sometimes 6 months, 12 months, sit vacant, while some poor potential homeowner is struggling to hope to move into their home because of clouded title. And so we have an opportunity to bring homeowners back into our neighborhoods that are highly impacted by foreclosures and to provide affordable housing opportunities and homes for families and individuals with this eminent domain. Bill that's been proposed also assist with properties in need of demolition. And so please don't forget, it will also help foreclosed properties that people can rehab or move into as is and help to reinvest in our
neighborhood. Hey, Mr. Yes, do you have, for the witness and testifier, do you have an idea? Is this a 50-50 deal on the clouded title versus this, you know, distressed properties that need to be destroyed? Because previously to my remarks about the site not being destroyed, we've had to take down some. And frankly, we were happy to take them down, but we do have the same problem with the title. We didn't realize that this bill might fix that.
Chair Jackson, Representative Mahoney.
Ms. Shoquist.
Very good point. I wish I knew. We're in a gathering data as we go through the NFP plan, and the stories that I have for you at this point are anecdotal. But perhaps if I spent a little bit of time explaining shortly, hopefully not repeating other comments, Minneapolis' foreclosure recovery might shed a little bit of light on that for you. I provided a 4-page brochure on the City of Minneapolis' plan for about $14 million in neighborhood stabilization funds. And the part of the plan that will most be impacted by this proposal for eminent domain is our opportunity to reinvest in our neighborhood. Minneapolis currently has, we had in 2008, 3,000 foreclosures. We're projecting 3,000 foreclosures for 2009. We have a vacant and boarded list, which is not necessarily properties that are foreclosed and not necessarily properties that will be condemned, but there are 830 properties currently on our vacant and boarded list. Of those, we're expecting there's probably about a third of them that we won't be able to work with existing owners and with repair orders where demolition may be necessary simply because it's not cost-effective to repair those properties. We believe that this is an important tool in our foreclosure recovery efforts for neighborhood reinvestment. It's important to remove blight and blighting influences to bring properties back into the hands of homeowners. Whether it's the story that I explained where we have people purchasing properties now that they can't clear title, oftentimes they have to let those properties go and purchase another property that may not be foreclosed and may be an area of the city or outside of the city altogether. And then also the situation where there is a blighted structure and it's causing the properties causing a problem in the neighborhood, bringing down home flat values, et cetera, and those would be helpful for that as well. If you look at our foreclosure plan for our $14 million in neighborhood stabilization funds under ERA, you'll see that about the third row down, there is a series of blue boxes which talk about City of Minneapolis investment for demolition and land banking. And there's a series of green boxes where we're acquiring properties for rehab and redevelopment, some for nonprofits. developers and some for for-profit developers. All of these will be have a potential of being impacted by this clouded title issue. And if and I wish we had numbers from our lenders and from others. At this point, we only have anecdotal information, but it is enough of a
Michelle, was you could wrap it up.
I think with that, I will just say thank you, and if there's any further questions, please let me know.
Any other questions? Does anyone else wish to testify in favor or in opposition? Forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Christine Berger. I'm with the Minnesota Association of Realtors, and we do understand the magnitude of the problem. However, we do have some concerns, and we'd just like to pose a few questions for the committee. We did want to point out in terms of what's identified on lines 1.12 and 1.13 of current law, they do have this authority to reduce the banner property currently and deal with blighted areas and public the other question, so we were questioning whether this new language would be necessary if they already have this authority. The second question we had was how many properties could be taken? Could it be an entire block? And that would be subject to this, and then would they be sold, or what would happen to them? What would be their subsequent use? It doesn't specify if it was for main housing or if it would be vacant lot or commercial, and then how often can this be executed within one of this targeted district? It's kind of pushing local governments into the real estate business, which I don't think they really want to be, as difficult as it is right now, as realtors will tell you. And if you are someone selling outside of this targeted neighborhood district and you want to sell your house and you're competing against the city, challenging to sell your home these days. So, again, we just pose the question, is this language necessary because we already have some current law authority on line 1.12, 1.13, and then how many homes can be taken? Could it be a whole block? How often could this happen, and what would be the subsequent use?
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Holder.
I'm sure they're not to the testifiers. I don't know if you want me to wait, so after the other further bill.
Oh, all right. We've got an amendment to testify. I was identifying yourself in the record. And I'm sorry, Representative Western, did you want to ask a question?
Go on, go on, go ahead.
Okay, all right, please identify yourself.
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify against House Bill 1537. My name is Jason Adkins. I'm a staff attorney at the Minnesota chapter of the Institute for Justice. My law firm has long been involved in the issue of eminent domain, including representing Suzette Kelo in her battle against the city of New London, Connecticut, in front of the United States Supreme Court. Suzette lost that case, but the American people's reaction to that loss was dramatic. It showed that an overwhelming majority of Americans, perhaps 85%, opposed the inclusion of private development as part of the definition of public use. My firm opposes this bill because it does the very same thing. It expands the definition of public use so that municipalities can condemn and take control of private property and then sell it to someone else. We believe the enormous power of eminent domain, what the founders called the despotic power, should only be used for real public uses. The compromise was reached by the legislature in 2006 that allowed for a slightly wider definition of public use, and this bill undermines that thoughtful compromise. In addition to upending that compromise, this bill is not necessary. Representative Hayden's other bill, heard earlier by this committee, demonstrates that there are other, more targeted answers to meet the foreclosure problem. We believe this bill is simply a pretext for cities to engage in long-desired redevelopment projects, something Minnesotans overwhelmingly rejected with the eminent domain reforms of 2006. Most importantly, there is no need for condemnation powers because the banks that foreclose on the property are willing sellers. This bill being considered today misuses the power designed to take property from unwilling sellers and apply it where it is not needed to willing sellers. Now, Mr. Ireland's comments earlier are well taken, but the fact of the matter is that someone still owns that property, and using eminent domain is an extraordinary measure, to say the least. Finally, if there's a problem identifying property owners, it cannot be a big problem considering the sophistication of the title recorders in the Twin Cities, there is no need to address a small and technical information data problem with the hammer of eminent domain. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Any further discussion or questions? Representative Colbert, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm sorry, I just got out of transportation, so I apologize if this has already been asked, but in the A1 amendment that I believe was adopted on line 1.3, one of the standards is the property that has not been maintained. So whose standard?
Representative Mullery?
Madam Chair, so is that subjective, or do we know what the standard is, or? Was it always your intent that commercial property be involved as well, or is it just with the A1 amendment that you added commercial property? Was it your intent to include commercial property? And, Madam Chair, just one additional question. Does
Chair, I apologize to Representative Mullery. I was at another committee as well. In a simple way, what exactly is the public use that is being identified here?
Representative Mullery.
Madam Chair, Representative Ruskowski, what is being changed in a highly concentrated area of foreclosures, which is in the HERA, the federal definition, or in the targeted areas, then they can use it where the unoccupied and unused is 6 months instead of what is in the laws 1 year. And the other category is the 2 years of taxes reduced taxes. Specific narrow areas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Representative Mullery, what is the public's interest? What is the public's interest in enabling this to happen?
Madam Chair, Representative Truskowski, Bruce testimony for about 45 minutes on that. The public's interest is to try to deal with the problems that are occurring from the foreclosed properties in concentrated areas, usually in the inner cities, most often in poverty areas. Now, Brooklyn Park has certain areas like that also.
Madam Chair, I guess Representative Mullery, but maybe to the realtor testimony. I'm kind of blank. Because I guess I have a little of a concern of how long will a city maintain that property? Will they put it back in the market? Will they overpay for it? If it's abandoned and nobody's been able to sell it. There could be a scenario where basically the city and the taxpayers are now going to clean it up, tear it down, and not going to be able to sell it for what they've got in it anyways. And then are they going to just hold it? Are they going to sell it to somebody cheap? What are they going to do to get it back on the tax rolls? And ultimately, there's businesses, there's people in business out there that do take distressed or abandoned properties and rehab them, and now all of a sudden when we have the city being a competitor for those businesses, and potentially if the city overpays for that property, you've now charged the taxpayers more than they needed to pay. You've maybe made the lender whole, but the business person that might be in this business isn't interested in the price of these. So, just any remarks or comments to any of those issues? I just have that concern broadly when we start looking at this.
Madam Chair, from to your question about, I guess it's how long will a city have to hold on to a property? But as I said in my previous statements, it's kind of like they're unwilling, local governments are unwillingly or unwillingly getting into the real estate business once they acquire these properties. I don't know how long they'll have to hold on to them, quite honestly. It sounds like they may be getting into some land banking. I don't know how long. I mean, we are in the private market, we are having a hard time selling properties, and I'm assuming that the same thing would happen with governments, that they're having a hard time selling properties as well. So I don't have an answer for you about how long. But it does seem that there will be a financial burden on the city that is, for sellers and realtors who are also trying to sell properties. And they'd be competing against, sellers and realtors would be competing against cities that are also trying to sell properties. So.
Thank you. Representative Muller, I'm going to let you have any final remarks before we have our roll call vote.
I think it's very apparent that this is needed to help with the closure problems. Witnesses wanted to come up and explain something, but I think people have really heard a lot on this. Let's go ahead.
Madam Chair, can I just ask, does the property have to be in foreclosure to qualify to be taken by the government?
Madam Chair, Representative Holbrook, it doesn't have to be. It has to be in a concentrated area of heavy foreclosures, as in the HERA definitions, which is the foreclosure-related act by the federal government.
Representative Mallory. Representative Jackson.
Aye.
Representative Champion. Representative Draskowski. Representative Hillstrom.
Aye.
Representative Holbrook.
No.
Representative Portman.
to me by a constituent who works as the guardian ad litem. Kelly Reese, who is the guardian ad litem coordinator for Hennepin County, just called to speak about the issue.
I'm sorry, could you spell it?
Guardian ad litem, or my name?
No, your name.
My first name is Kelly, K-E-L-L-E-Y, and the last name is Leaf, L-E-A-F.
What is this, Leaf?
Thank you. I have a really small amendment to what's a pretty good, well, it's not an amendment, sorry. What we're looking at is Section F, primarily, and on House File 1527. And this is a situation that we have parents that have child protection cases, and when their children are in foster care, the state attempts to recover the cost of foster care through the parental fees unit. And so child support is actually being paid by parents while their children are in child protection, as it should be. They should help offset those costs. This bill came about because we had a mom who did everything that we asked her to do in a child protection case. She had four children. She was able to work a case plan and successfully become reunified with her children. She was able to work full-time, pay child support while she was doing her case plan. And her children were returned to her in what's called protective or supervised. Excuse me, I'm going to get the term wrong now. And I work there full-time. Trial home visit is what the legal term is. So the children were returned to her under a trial home visit and eventually reunified. During the trial home visit, mom's paycheck continued to be diverted to child support. The children were under her care. She was paying for the cost of their upkeep. She was paying for the cost of the apartment that she was required to keep. And she was paying for their food. And her income was so stretched by the child support requirement that she was forced to almost forgo her rent. She was barely escaped being evicted. And this is a mom that was doing what we asked of her, not receiving public assistance, working her case plan, working a job, getting her kids back, and fixing her life. And so what we're asking for is the language in Section F that simply diverts the money in child support payments when a parent has their children under a trial home visit. In this particular instance, our judge on the case, Judge Bransford, had to make a retroactive order in order to send that to the child support agency to stop the income withholding from mom's checks. And we're not talking about a lot of clients here. We're not talking about a lot of money. We're talking about money that's due the children on these cases. The guardian ad litem on this case had to call the child support agency herself. She had to walk over to the child support agency herself and deliver a court order from the judge explaining what had happened and why the money shouldn't be deducted from the mom's paycheck. And this is really a bill that's about the best interests of kids. What we want to do is we want to see kids in healthy families. We want to see families reunited. We want to see families not come back into the system and not cost us more money. We want to reward parents that are working and supporting themselves and their kids by not continuing to remove money from their care when they're not supposed to be having it removed. So I ask you to consider that language, and I would ask you to consider this bill.
Is there any opposition to this bill from anybody? Motion to pass House File 1627, and it goes to the General Register, is that correct? Okay, all say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. House File 265. Whoops. Yeah. Yes, correct.
Are you back?
I have so many questions, probably you have. Oh. Okay, I will move House File 1713 for Representative Abrams.
As soon as it will be all, if you want to move it, delete all and put the bill in order.
Is this the DE1?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
I'll move the DE1 bid and the shape the other ones. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
My name is Jerry Reed. I'm the executive director of the American Registry of Radiologic Technologists. The ART is a nonprofit organization based in Mendota Heights. We were formed more than 80 years ago in order to certify qualified individuals in interventional procedures and radiation therapy. As part of that mission, we developed and administer examinations to 15 different specialties. Those specialties include radiography, technology, radiation therapy, nuclear medicine technology, CT, MR, and a number of other categories. Many states, including Minnesota, use our examination in order to regulate who practices in those specialties. In other words, the individuals must pass the exam in order to work in those specialties. Before our exam is very important, helping ensure that competent, qualified people are working in those important areas of patient care. And that's why we're here today. Examination subversion, the deliberate and systematic cheating on examinations, is a growing problem. The Internet's made it much easier for individuals who are determined to cheat to distribute the stolen information, to sell it, and to individuals who are preparing to take the exam. Net security in general is an important issue. When the examination being cheated deals with identifying qualified individuals in medicine the way our exams do, we're talking about threats to the public health. What we need and what we ask for is Minnesota law that's targeted to the specific problem of test subversion. It's a tool we do not currently have that would help protect the security of these important examinations and protect the public. What we want to make sure is that individuals who become certified do so based upon their knowledge and skills, not based upon receiving the examination questions in advance. We have legal counsel here with us tonight, and if it's the will of the chair, he is prepared to review the text that we're proposing.
First, let's see, is there anybody in opposition to this? Both? Oppositions.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sri Sankaran. I'm a lawyer who represents the American Registry of Radiologic Technologists, and just very briefly, Section 9A of the bill describes the test subversion conduct that is prohibited. Section 9B of the bill provides that a person who is injured by that conduct can seek an injunction to stop it, and if they're damaged, they can try to recover their damages. Section 9D of the bill also provides that the prevailing party in a case, plaintiff or defendant, can be entitled to recover their attorney's fees if the other side has behaved in a way that's unjustified. For example, if the plaintiff brought a case that was groundless or the defendant engaged in willful test subversion activity.
Representative, since
our testimony, Mr. Chief.
Thank you. And since the crime was taken out, I believe it goes directly to the chair.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Chair removes the House Bill 1713 as amendment to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members.
Representative Portman, do you want to move your 265?
Members, it's an oral amendment. I would like to strike Article 2. The bill has two articles. The first article is to the Uniform Probate Code regarding how much property you have to avoid probate. $20,000 to $50,000. The second article is a bit technical, and it deals with the Anatomical Gift Act and makes some changes. And Mr. Chair, the Bar Association had asked me to carry the entire bill, and at this point, they haven't been able to get consensus on Article 2. My deletion of
control changes on the report?
On pages 1 through 4, no. It's just Article 2 is pages 5 and 9 deleted.
Okay, all in favor of amendments to delete Article 2 together with the one the author wants, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
Mr. Chair, if I might, can you tell me what you think is going to happen with all that language? Some people refer to that as the Economical Gifts Act. Some of us refer to it as the Frankenstein bill. And so, is it going to be a new bill, or how should we watch for this part of the bill? Is it alive in the Senate, or?
Mr. Chair, and do that. First, and then we can have the Department of Health come testify as to the second part. But my understanding is that they are sort of having this line forward as to what I was using. It's not jacketed with.
Representative Portland says you deleted Article 2.
Chair, Chair, I would just like to then note for the record that both the H from the Minnesota Department of Health is here this evening to testify. The deletion of that part. And Charlie Barber from the legislative liaison from the Minnesota Department of Health, and also Chair Dave from the Department of Health, would like to hold on. It's really an issue.
Yes, Representative Portman, go ahead with your vote.
Chair, I'd like to turn it over to
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Scott Nelson. I'm chair of the Legislative Issues Committee for the Probate and Trust Section of the Minnesota State Bar Association. And we are the originators of the probate bill that we have before you today. We have a couple of fairly small technical changes and then one change that we do think is very favorable to the public. The first changes are in Article 1, Sections 1, 2, and 4. And this is reinstating a section of the probate code that was inadvertently deleted as part of a reorganization of the judicial code. And it was actually brought to our attention by the revisor's office. And basically what we're doing is we're reinstating the provision that allows the courts the ability to correct, modify, vacate, or amend their records, orders, and decrees. It was the section in the probate statute 5.502 that was, it appears to have been inadvertently omitted. We went back and looked at the changes to the judicial code and didn't find anything equivalent that would give the courts the authorization to handle these types of issues that may come up in the probate area. So we have proposed to reinstate that section, as you see it in 5.4.1304. It's a more general provision in the probate statute. And then we also have two related sections in Article 1, Section 2 and 4, where we had cross-references to the deleted section that now are corrected to make cross-reference to the new reinstated section. The other piece of the legislation that we have is Article 1, Section 3, which deals with the ability by interested persons in a probate to collect personal property by affidavit. We've had a statute on the books, and it is part of the Uniform Probate Code that allows interested persons to collect property by affidavit if the total probate estate less liens and encumbrances is less than $20,000. And the $20,000 level, I believe, has been on the statute books since 1995. And we're proposing a change to the statute that would allow the use of the affidavit of collection for an estate where the probate assets less liens and encumbrances are less than $50,000. And I do understand there has been a couple of situations where the public actually has approached representatives in the legislature complaining about the $20,000 limit, and we did believe that it was time to consider an increase in that level. In some ways, it might be seen as an anti-attorney statute because it allows people basically to handle the probate issues without having to go through probate and without having to hire an attorney. But we do believe that that it is an appropriate change for the legislature to consider.
Mr. Chair, while it might be an anti-attorney
Representative Westrom, that is correct.
Is there anyone wanting to testify on this post in favor of it? Okay, sorry, Representative Jackson.
I have a question about this. If you mistake or error in advertence, there is a decree distributing real property, which then is in turn sold to a purchaser. This ability to go back 2 years is not going to affect the waterfront purchaser's right to use property, would it?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that probably is more of a real estate related question, and I'm not an expert in that area, but I would presume that the real estate law would not allow a bona fide, a situation where you have a bona fide purchaser to, override the title standards and the transfer of the title in a case like that.
I have a question, Mr. Nelson. Going back, there's been some fraud on those affidavits for collection of personal property. Have you considered about when you're going up to 50,000, they can get a lot of weight? Or was that considered?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, yes, it was considered. The number of those types of cases I'm not sure of. We do hear from time to time that there are some protections in the existing statute that we're not changing. We're basically all we're doing is changing the level from 20,000 to 50,000. But there is, for example, a provision that if there's a probate proceeding or where a petition has been filed for a probate proceeding, so if there was an interested person that was aware of possible fraud, they might be able to petition the court and avoid the affidavit of collection process altogether. I know that the Department of Human Services also has, some powers in situations where they may have claims against the estate, and they can actually bring the property back into a probate proceeding if they can show that they have prior claims against the property.
Mr. Nelson, I'm aware of those, but there were many situations where they got a form from a bank or something like that, and go and do the collection, and then it'd be gone when other people tried to trace it down. But apparently, that's concerned them that much. So, I don't believe there's anybody else testifying on it. Just as Weber said, it's not testifying on it. So, Representative Portman renews her motion to pass House file 265 as amended to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
Carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
This isn't it down.
He's here so much, we should just put him on the table.
Gee, we call on it. Is it that late? To
unfortunately, yes, the answer that question.
You just hear that there was speaking of thought of getting you a chair here since you're here so often.
That would be nice. Could I get a nameplate and the whole bit?
I guess so. Representative Tony moves the House File 1687 to the General Register. Representative,
yeah, that's my understanding. Yes, Mr. Chair.
Is there any amendments?
Well, unfortunately, in consultation with the Bar Association, I've got one small oral amendment and one more complicated one, and I might require staff assistance to ensure that I get these right. On page 2, line 3, the effective date, language, delete June and insert August.
And then a question or is it first?
Between us, you're the lawyer.
Yes.
for my comfort at least, I'd like to keep that in, even though it's
make you comfortable.
Thank you. Well, you were offering earlier to make me comfortable as well. Now, on starting on
represent, we will deal with one
at a time. Upset.
All in favor of the amendment so far from June to August to get in the shape the author wants, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
This next one is more complicated. Page 2, line 22. Again, we're in effective date territory. Again, delete June and insert August. And then on page 2, line 23, after the word deed, a little lengthy, my apologies, Mr. Chair, in which the notice of cancellation, is first served or published. Again, is first served or published on or after August 1, 2000. On or after August 1, 2009.
Representative,
and I'm actually, unfortunately, not done. I know. The Bar Association provides significant services to the people of Minnesota. On that same line, 223. Delete the language commenced on or after that. And insert after the word foreclosures, insert under Chapter 581. Foreclosures, insert under Chapter 581. And I've got one more clause. My apologies, Mr. Chair. In which the lease pendants is recorded. In which the lease pendants is recorded on or after August 1, 2009. On or after August 1. We could probably do more if you ask.
Maybe you want to take out the word date on 224?
Excuse me?
You want to take out the word date on 224?
Yes.
Say that.
I was leaving it for you, Mr. Chair. And again, my apologies.
I will try to read this back. Oh, Matt, you want to read it?
Mr. Chair. To clarify on 2.23 that the first or that it should be at the end. So it's applying to cancellations of contracts for deeds and or foreclosures.
Sounds correct. Thank you, Mr. Gare.
So that changes the effective date would read this section is effective August 1st, 2009 and applies to cancellations of contracts for deed in which the notice of cancellation is first served or published on or after August 1st, 2009, and mortgage foreclosures under Chapter 581, in which the list pendants is recorded on or after August 1st, 2009.
I do, Mr. Chair, and my thank you, Mr. Garing, for the assistance.
Okay, all in favor of that lengthy amendment to get it in the shape the author wants, say aye.
Mr. Chair, I'm hoping the discussion on the bill is shorter.
Well,
so. Should I be standing? Last year, this legislation worked collaboratively, actually under the chair's leadership, with a broad array of stakeholders to assure tenants and homeowners subject to foreclosure proceedings receive adequate, timely, and helpful information on the foreclosure process, the rights and responsibilities and resources available to them. As good as it was, we missed a few details. House File 1697 as amended is essentially a technical bill updating a few missed statutory references. It assures the tenants and properties being foreclosed by action have the same notice requirements and that landlords being foreclosed by action are held to the same lease limitations. The amendment, done there. I'm going to stop. Thank you. I'm getting the message.